science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
All right. How are we?
Good. Good,
we're
thanks.
Good. We've established that.
Yeah, we are.
And we're going to talk about cell phones now.
Yes. So this is something I think that appeared in the Herald this week, but it's based on some work that was done and released earlier this year on cell phones. And so there's been this sort of rumbling background of our cell phones going to kill us, give us
for
cancer.
A long time.
For quite a long time. Yeah, as far as I can remember.
Yeah. And I thought that we would have established that they're probably pretty bad.
Yeah. Well. Sort of and sort of not.
Okay.
Yeah, so they did a few studies. So there's been rumbling background of our cell phone's going to give us cancer and things like that for a long time. So they studied the effect of cell phones in mice, okay, because mice and humans apparently very similar.
Okay.
And the cell phones, they emit radiation. Obviously, they've got to communicate with the cell phone towers, and the cell phone towers communicate with your little device in your hand. And they do this by emitting electromagnetic radiation, so radio waves. Okay, and these are similar to the radio waves that are emitted by your microwave oven. Okay,
which is bad.
Which, well, it's good if you want to heat your
handy.
Hot chocolate up
very
or something.
Very useful.
Yeah,
very but, efficient, but yeah. Not great.
But not
in terms
if
of
you
radiation.
Want to heat your head up. Right, and so there's this question, you know, prolonged use of cell phones with that radiation close to your ear or your head, your brain, is that going to give you problems? So they did this study, and it lasted 2 years, and they basically confined some rats and some mice of both sexes to a sort of specially constructed chamber. Where they basically reverberated microwaves, okay, over a long period of time. So the levels range, and these are power levels, so they're in watts, and so the levels of microwaves range from about 1.5 watts up to about 10 watts per kilogram, okay? And so just to get a bearing, a cell phone emits up to about 3 watts of energy, of power, okay? Compared to your microwave oven, which emits, in terms of electromagnetic radiation, microwaves emits about 700 watts.
Oh, okay.
So it's a big difference,
yes.
200 plus times difference,
yep.
Yeah? But you don't use your microwave oven next to your ear, and you don't use it for hours a day, okay? Which you do use your cell phone, yeah. And so this was limited to 2G and 3G frequencies, so not super fast 4G frequencies, but still. And the amount of radiation these mice were getting far exceeded U.S. regulations. Okay, so they were getting more than you would dose yourself with. Okay,
and more than you would consider safe.
Probably, although we don't really know what is safe. Yeah.
Okay.
And so the exposure began during pregnancy. They were exposed for about 9 hours a day for about 2 years. So that's a lot of use. And obviously, most people don't have that much exposure. So the findings were, again, not terribly convincing. So the strongest finding was that male rats had an elevated risk of developing tumors called, I'm going to say this wrong, malignant schwannomas, and that's in the connective tissue surrounding nerves in the heart. Okay, so that was the strongest finding. Weaker findings were that there were sex and species-dependent increases for lymphoma, as well as prostate, skin, lung, liver, brain cancers. But again, those were weaker findings, so they're statistically maybe not so significant. There were other non-cancerous effects, so there were lower birth weights, evidence of DNA damage, heart conditions, but again, not clear whether they were caused by the radiation exposure or by something else. So statistically, maybe there's some effect, but it's not particularly strong, okay? But there's people on this argument on both sides. So there's some people who are strongly of the opinion that cell phones do harm, and so they were taking the evidence that they did do harm. So there were critics of cell phone use that said that the new findings are really important, and this is clear evidence that radio frequencies cause cancer and other things, and you know the amount of evidence now has reached some sort of statistical sort of significance. And then others, principally some, the director of the FDA or the FDA Center for Devices and Radiological Health, said they don't really suggest that regulations need to be changed or tightened at all. So,
but there is obviously that, I mean, that's evidence that there is some level of risk of being harmed in some way.
There is possible evidence
of
risk.
Very minor,
yeah,
perhaps, but...
Through really extensive use, yes.
So something that we should be aware of regardless.
Probably. Whether that translates to humans, you know,
right,
there could be differences there as well, obviously. But...
And if our technology is increasingly more advanced,
right,
like you said, that study wasn't about 5G, for example.
Yeah,
as one,
or for
as
even
one,
4G. Yes.
Yeah, as one, yeah, aspect. And then there are other aspects that are...
Right. But, you know, you can take this and you realize that, okay, so there is much, much stronger evidence that smoking causes cancer. There's much, much evidence that drinking alcohol causes health issues. And we still do it. All right? So whether, even if there is a fairly strong link between cell phones and some sort of tumors... you know, are we really going to deprive ourselves of our cell phones?
Right.
Probably
I see where
not.
You're going there. Okay. No, yeah. Well, that's a fair point. There's obviously other things that are far more likely to kill us.
Yes.
I guess it's part of that kind of moral panic thing, though, when you do get new technology and what...
Well, I think it's definitely worth trying to figure out if it's going to hurt us.
Yeah. So these experiments will continue because they're still kind of blurry?
Yeah, I think so. And they're going to investigate the different frequencies of the 4G sort of band of frequencies that most people, I guess, are using now.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we'll see.
Okay. Second story, hydropower. Is it sustainable?
Is it good for us? Hydropower, you know, it's basically the leading source of renewable energy around the world. So in 2016, it supplied about 70%, 71% of supply globally. So, you know, you think it's green, you know, it's water, there's no greenhouse emissions, it's all good really, isn't it?
Well, I don't know a lot about it, to be honest.
Well,
but yeah, you'd assume that, I guess it's a... But isn't it... Anyway, you explain.
Okay. Well, this is important for New Zealand, obviously, because New Zealand generates a lot of electricity by damming lakes and rivers. So what we find across Europe and North America, most of the capacities, the really big hydroelectric power projects, were built in between 1920 and 1970. And, you know, they're the big, really big, like the Hoover Dam and big dam, famous dams that you've probably heard of. And thousands of dams were built, okay? And then after that, the big dams stopped being built in developing nations because most of the best sites were already developed. Yeah. And people started realizing there was social and environmental costs concerned with these hydroelectric power, you know, stations.
Such as.
Well, environmentally, so
it essentially dries stuff up.
Well, it does. So you're disrupting river ecologies. You're deforesting. Okay, you're losing aquatic and terrestrial biodiversity. You're actually releasing greenhouse gases. So you flood big areas with these dams, and principally methane, which is a very, very powerful greenhouse gas, is produced because all that vegetation that was there rots away, and all the gases go up into the atmosphere. You displace thousands and thousands of people often. And you're affecting the food system, water quality, agriculture, all sorts of different things. And the overall cost of this, you know, the overall effect on the environment and on people has been dramatically underestimated.
Were dams a Western project? Was this something that kind of came out of the Western world? Because there were, in other parts of the world, there are other ways of collecting water and directing water and those sorts of systems.
Well, I think I'm not an expert on dams. I mean, I think we've been directing and collecting water for a very, very, very long time globally. But these really big dam projects were sort of in the middle of the 20th century, were being mainly built in the Western world, so in America and in Europe. But now they're moving to the developing world.
Okay? Oh, okay.
So there's some really big, so the Mekong River Basin, the Amazon River Basin, and the Congo in Africa River Basin, they're all being targeted as potential sites for big, major, major dam project, because I mean, Brazil gets about 70% of its power from hydroelectric. You know, there's a lot of potential there. Yeah, the Amazon's a huge river, and so the, you know, these risks and problems are moving to developing countries, and you know, there's really a big cost. People are now realizing a big cost.
And so we're seeing these costs because there's been disastrous sort of environmental effects in the areas that those dams are currently. So like you say, in the developed world, are you saying that they've stopped using hydropower?
No, they're not stopped. The number of big dam projects has really decreased.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, there are a few dam projects that are being proposed or being built currently in New Zealand, for instance. There's three particularly major ones, and several more that are that are under development. But they tend to be smaller. They tend to be not the really giant things that, mm-hmm. that have the biggest most disastrous effects. And so you know, there's various reports here. So there's analysis of about 250 big dams built between about 1934 and 2007. So the cost of these dams were about 96% higher than predicted. One out of 10 dams cost up to three times more than they originally thought. 40 to 80 million people were displaced during that period from dam development. So that's a huge human cost. Yeah, a conservative estimate is that 472 million people worldwide have been negatively infected by dam constructed. So nearly half a billion people have been negatively affected. So the question is, do we still want to build
dams? Yeah, it sounds
dams?
Like we don't want to do that.
Well, there's ways around it. So you can do it more sustainably. Yeah. So we need to certainly pay more attention to how climate change affects hydropower production. You know, if we make smaller, so they call it micro hydropower, so smaller, more sustainable dam projects rather than the giant, massive things that we've done in the past. We make a greater effort to reduce environmental and social costs. The people who are harmed by the dams need to be compensated properly. You know, we try not to have to resettle lots and lots of people. And really importantly, we need to bring online some innovative technologies that reduce some of the negative outcomes. So can we make the generation of energy more efficient? Can we, you know, change the turbines or whatever to make renewable energy? You don't have to have these massive reservoirs and things, the areas that need to be flooded. But it's a big question for New Zealand, because we in the last, you know, 10 or so years, we've been generating 50 to 60% of power in New Zealand with hydroelectricity. So
it's almost as though we also just need to get new ideas for power.
New ideas, yeah, and don't underestimate the environmental and social costs of hydroelectricity.
Someone also just texted in saying there's also a massive amount of CO2 released in the production of so much concrete to make the dams. That's another
I'm sure there is, yeah,
added
absolutely.
Point.
Yeah.
And somebody's asked about the first story. Are the radio waves in the air regardless of whether we're holding a phone to our ear or not?
Yes, they are. But
So proximity to your body doesn't necessarily matter, or will it?
Well, no, it does
increase?
because really your phone is a little transmitter. So the concentration of energy is closest next to your phone. You know, when you move your phone away from your head, away from your body, or you're just walking around and having radio waves surrounding you, the power that you're feeling is very, very, very much lower. So okay. The risks there are going to be very, very small.
All right, we need some time for this last story, because I'm guessing it's going to take some time.
A fifth form
of matter has been created in space by scientists.
Okay, so the fifth form of matter is maybe not the exciting part. The exciting part that was created in space. So,
that's what I thought. Some people were creating stuff in space.
In space.
Yeah.
So forms of matter. You know, we're familiar with solids, liquids, and gases. So that's three. You can also count plasma, which is basically a gas of charged particles. So that's really what's inside the sun and other places like that. And then this fifth one is called a Bose-Einstein condensate, which is not...
It's a long
It's
word.
Not really a quite an easy thing to say. But predicted by Mr. Einstein and an Indian guy called Bose, not the makers of the headphones, this is a really sort of a unique thing where if you take some atoms, and it doesn't work with all atoms, just some atoms, just individual atoms, and you collect them together and you cool them down, right the way down, very close to the coldest you can actually get, And when they get very, very cold, just a few degrees or a few fractions of a fraction of a degree above absolute zero, the atoms are really hardly moving. They've got no energy. You know, you've cooled them down so much. And at that point, they clump together. Not clumping together in the sense that sort of we understand it, but yeah. You know that the analogy is raindrops. So raindrops collecting, okay. You know, individual drops yes. clump together and yes. they form a pool. Okay, yes. And in that pool, you can't tell the individual raindrops. They've yep. sort of become one thing, and that's what happens to these atoms. They don't they change from being individual little dots of matter, these atoms, to become sort of super atom,
new
big
form
thing,
of matter.
Which is this new form of matter.
Wow.
And this was discovered in the 90s, and some people got some Nobel Prizes for it in sort of around 2000. And the point is, so to make it, you have to cool these things down. You cool it with, you don't need a, you know, can't use a fridge, you cool it actually with a laser. You actually fire a laser at these things, and the laser just slowly drops the energy in the collection of atoms, you know, very, very carefully. And then you have to use a few other techniques to cool it. And then basically the atoms all fall into this into a single quantum state. And at that point, they obeyed some laws that were written down originally by Einstein and Bose. And these laws are very similar to things to the way we describe other particles like photons, which are the original, you know, the bits of light that hit us, okay? So why should we care? So the why is this even important? Well, for a few moments on January the 23rd of last year, the coldest spot in the known universe was this tiny little spot on a tiny microchip hovering about 150 miles above a town in Sweden. Yeah. And this chip was really small, about the size of a postage stamp, and it was packed with thousands of rubidium atoms. And rubidium is an element, it's similar to potassium. And these atoms were being cooled down inside a rocket that had been launched, a 40-foot-long rocket that was launched. It wasn't launched into orbit, it just went up and then sort of dropped down again. And they were cooled to about minus 273 degrees Celsius. Or a little bit colder than that even, and this was colder than anything else in what we know in the universe. Yeah. And the rocket sort of bobbed around in low gravity for about 6 minutes, and inside that rocket within this little chip, they formed this little Bose-Einstein condensate.
Right? Wow!
Obviously, the first time scientists have created one in space, but again, why is it useful? So. All these atoms suddenly became when they formed this condensate, just like all the little water droplets, they become indistinguishable, okay, and they sort of form this sort of globule of matter that is sort of slowly vibrating and moving, and it's got a well-defined wavelength and things like that, and it's so delicate that it can actually pick up the tiniest little disturbances, okay, and this is useful when we want to detect tiny little disturbances, which is what happens when gravitational waves pass through us or around us. Okay, so you may have heard of, maybe Alan talked about gravitational waves and gravitational wave detection and things, which was a big story last year. Mm-hmm. And this is a potential way to detect gravitational waves. Now the question is, why do it in space? Why can't we just do it in the lab? Well, in that these things have to be formed in a tube. And they can't be touching anything else. So what happens is they form, but when these condensates form, they sort of form and then drop to the bottom of the tube, and then they're gone. Okay. So you want a place where there's no gravity.
I see.
All right. So when there's no gravity, these things can, you know, stick around for a while and potentially indefinitely if we're able to do it in orbit where there's really no gravity. And so what we can do then is start to look at these Bose-Einstein condensates as ways to detect gravitational waves and other tiny little disturbances that all these cosmologists and other people
Brilliant.
Are interested in. Yeah.
Brilliant. That's cool.
Well, it's cool.
It's very cool. Very, very cold. That's awesome. Thank you, okay. Marcus.
No
we'll
problem.
See you in 2 weeks.
Good.
That was Dear Science.